In 2006, Toshiba paid $5 billion for Westinghouse Electric, America's premier nuclear energy company, one of the founders of the industry. The acquisition and subsequent build of four new nuclear power reactors ruined them. A 140-year-old company, one of Japan's proudest, now torn apart. In this video, we look at perhaps the worst acquisition in Japanese corporate history. Just a friendly reminder about the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first with selected references. Early access really helps a lot, and I appreciate every pledge. Thank you, and on with the show. The modern Toshiba is the child of a merger between two Japanese electrical equipment companies. The first and more famous half is Shibara Engineering, founded by the famed inventor Tanaka Hisashige. Born in 1799, Hisashige was a famed engineer and inventor during the Tokugawa shogunate era. He first gained renown at the age of 20 for inventing a cool mechanical puppet. Then over a long and fruitful career, he produced clocks, lamps, bicycles, steam engines, fire extinguishers, and more. He was basically Japan's Thomas Edison. A few years after the Meiji Restoration, Tanaka was asked to come to Tokyo to help with the country's modernization, particularly its telegraph network. And despite being 74 years old, he founded what would eventually become Shibara. After Tanaka died in 1881, his adopted son took over. The company at first expanded thanks to military orders, but in 1893 suddenly went bankrupt after losing an important Japanese Navy contract. Their creditors, the Mitsui Bank, bought the assets and revived them. The new company acquired foreign technologies to produce hydroelectric generators, electric motors, and other equipment. These products remain at the heart of Toshiba's biggest businesses. Then in 1910, the American General Electric Company made an investment in Shibara, linking them to their eventual merger partner. That partner was Hakone Tsusha, a lighting company founded by a young University of Tokyo professor and former worker at Shibara. The company produced Japan's first domestic light bulbs, but struggled to compete due to costs and intense foreign competition. So in 1905, they sold a majority share to General Electric, renaming themselves to Tokyo Electric and adopting GE's innovations like the tungsten filament. Since the two companies were similar and shared GE as a common major shareholder, a merger made sense. So in 1939, the two joined and created a new company, Tokyo Shibara Denki, colloquially shortened to Toshiba. GE sold their Toshiba shares after the war ended, and as the country recovered, the Mitsui Group's backing helped Toshiba access materials to produce broadcasting equipment, digital computers, and other electronics. However, the company's old-fashioned business practices and bureaucracy weighed on them. Mountains of paperwork to deal with, and a group of snobby executives who were, at best, uninterested in actually running the company. It made it difficult to create new products. When an economic downturn struck Toshiba hard in the early 1960s, the company brought in Toshio Doko as chairman. Doko had previously turned around a failing shipyard into one of Japan's top shipbuilding companies. Doko is widely beloved for his honesty, hard work ethic, and frugal lifestyle. He donated almost all of his salary to charity, and his house didn't even have air conditioning. The honest and likable Doko right-sized Toshiba's finances and revitalized its businesses. Toshiba became one of Japan's top conglomerates, offering memory semiconductors, consumer electronics, and more, in addition to their core power generation assets. Their semiconductors were especially formidable. In 1985, they won the race to develop and ramp up the first 1 megabit DRAM chip. 2 years later, they had half of the world's market share in 1 megabit. And despite a very public 1987 scandal involving illegal exports to the Soviet Union, Toshiba in the late 1980s was at the top of its game. But then came the bursting of the Japanese real estate bubble and the lost decades that followed. Large storied Japanese companies like Toshiba faced a shrinking market at home. And abroad, rising competition from the Koreans and Chinese threatened their traditional positions. Toshiba and its old guard leader struggled to compete. They were not the only Japanese company dealing with this. By the early 2000s, there was a turn towards outsider-type leaders who were seen as bringing fresh perspective. One classic example is the Sony Group making Sir Howard Stringer its new CEO in 2005. Stringer had come up through Sony's media business. And Sanyo, that same year, made Tomoyo Nonaka its chairperson and CEO. She was a former anchorwoman and journalist with no prior experience in senior management or electronics. At the time, Toshiba, particularly its electronics businesses, had matured and were suffering its own challenges. Thusly, in June 2005, Toshiba appointed Atsutoshi Nishida as their new president and CEO. And Nishida certainly fits all the criteria to be an outsider executive. After first considering a doctorate in German history, Nishida instead decided to join Toshiba's Iran affiliate. He married an Iranian woman and then joined Toshiba's headquarters in Japan at the age of 31. Throughout the 1990s, he rose up through Toshiba's PC business. He first led them into the profitable laptop category and supposedly turned around the division twice. He first did so in the 1990s after the arrival of low-cost PC makers like Compaq. The second time supposedly came in 2003. The business again lost money and fell into a crisis. Nishida had expected to be made Toshiba's CEO and president, but how can Toshiba anoint someone from a money-losing division? Determined, Nishida introduced new laptops and hired Taiwanese contract manufacturer companies and Chinese laborers to make them. By 2004, over 80% of production was outsourced, but the PC division returned to profitability that year ahead of schedule. By 2005, Toshiba was the world's third largest notebook PC vendor after Dell and HP. The turnaround seemed complete, and the company promoted Nishida to the top spot. The chain-smoking executive was known for being unusually aggressive and willing to make bold moves. One of those bold moves was the fateful 2006 acquisition of America's leading nuclear energy company. Nuclear energy. Bold strategy indeed. Let's see if it pays off for them. And now for something completely different. Let's talk nuclear reactors. Westinghouse Electric Company began as the nuclear power division of the Westinghouse Company. The elder Westinghouse Company is quite famous. Founded by the legendary inventor George Westinghouse, it pioneered alternating current motors and transformers, the electrical kind. Their nuclear energy division emerged after World War II, thanks to a military partnership with the U.S. government. In 1949, Admiral Hyman George Rickover became head of the nuclear power branch of the Navy's Bureau of Ships. He was a brilliant, pugnacious, and abrasive electrical engineer born in Poland. That same year, 1949, the Soviet Union detonated their first nuclear weapon, kicking off the Cold War. This Soviet breakthrough provided the military impetus for a submarine with unlimited endurance and high submerged speed. Rickover moved heaven, earth, and government bureaucracy to make it happen. Rickover and his team began developing two known reactor designs and assigned one each to a different military contractor. The three ways to classify a nuclear reactor are by the fuel they use within their core, the moderator material they use to slow down neutrons inside said core, and the coolant they use to cool the reactor core. General Electric was contracted to develop a liquid sodium reactor, meaning it used molten sodium as the coolant and graphite as the moderator. Westinghouse, on the other hand, was contracted to develop a water-cooled reactor design, first created at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. It had two water circuits, a primary and secondary. Water in the primary circuit is pumped at high pressure through the uranium-powered reactor. The water in this circuit heats up, but does not boil or evaporate due to said pressure. The heat is then transferred from the primary to secondary circuit. That heat thusly creates steam for running the turbine, which is why we call these nuclear steam supply systems. These systems are paired with a turbine generator that turns the steam into power. The largest American vendors of such turbines are Westinghouse and General Electric. What a coincidence. This particular nuclear steam supply system design later received the name Pressurized Water Reactor, or PWR, and its first prototype went critical in 1953. Steaming ahead at full speed, Rickover had pushed Westinghouse to build a modified variant at a slightly slower time frame for installation into the first nuclear-powered submarine. That submarine, named the Nautilus, was commissioned in January 1955. Right off the bat, it demonstrated nuclear power's superior performance. In its first cruise, the sub traveled 10 times further than any previous sub, and at far superior submerged speeds. General Electric's sodium-cooled reactor design was later installed in a second submarine, the Seawolf. However, the potential explosion risks of the molten sodium reacting with the seawater led to a conversion. Sodium-cooled reactors later fell out of style, so GE took up a design called the Boiling Water Reactor, or BWR. It's similar to a PWR in that it uses water as the moderator and coolant, but attempts to simplify the design. The BWR cuts the number of water circuits from 2 to 1. Steam is generated not in the secondary circuit, but inside the core itself, boiling like a teapot. The steam is then directly delivered to the turbine. As I said, PWRs and BWRs are very similar. Maybe one difference is that since pressurized water tends to carry heat better, PWRs can deliver roughly twice more power per unit volume of core than the BWR. But anyhow, Westinghouse came to dominate the PWR and GE the BWR. After the Nautilus, Rickover got involved in developing a nuclear reactor to power an aircraft carrier. This reactor had to be much larger, and people recognized its potential value for generating electricity. But then in 1953, the incoming Eisenhower administration proposed to abandon that project. Undeterred, Rickover argued to merge the carrier project with a civilian power project based on a scaled-up submarine design. The administration was at first reluctant, but after learning about Soviet and British efforts to build power-generating nuclear reactors, they backed the effort as part of Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace initiative. The result was Shippingport, which achieved criticality in 1958. It is the world's first large-scale nuclear reactor to generate power for exclusive civilian use. The UK's gas-cooled Calder Hall started earlier, but produced nuclear weapons material in addition to power. Because Shippingport was a civilian project, its work, design features, and operation were declassified. The plant hosted hundreds of visitors, many foreign. Their staff held technical seminars and training courses, and we might call it the world's most closely studied PWR. With that being said, the actual design of all of Westinghouse's subsequent PWRs descend from its second commercial power plant, Yankee Row, which went critical in 1960. Westinghouse and General Electric soon after began to aggressively pursue the commercial power utility market. The issue was cost. Nuclear power plants are the biggest, most complicated, and priciest items ever sold in the civilian sector. It is hard to imagine them being competitive with the mature fossil fuels industry. In 1962, coal plants costed about $110 to $140 per kilowatt. And even with subsidies from the American Atomic Energy Commission, or AEC, valued at around $20 per kilowatt, Westinghouse's next two power plants, Connecticut Yankee and San Onofre 1, cost about $153 and $180 per kilowatt, respectively. So to overcome customer reluctance about the plant's economics and kickstart the industry, Westinghouse and GE offered the utilities what are called turnkey terms. It means the vendors take on all the designing, building, testing, and meeting regulations for a fixed price. They just turned the key over to the utility customer at the end. Such terms are extremely rare in the U.S. power generation industry. Prior to this, they were offered mostly to foreign utilities, unexperienced in construction. Finally, in late December 1963, the Jersey Central Power Utility agreed to a turnkey deal with Westinghouse for the Oyster Creek Power Plant at around $132 per kilowatt. This broke through, and in the next 2 years, about 13 more reactors were ordered on terms similar to those of Oyster Creek. Westinghouse and General Electric's willingness to offer turnkey terms helped cement the market dominance of water-cooled reactor designs. Alternative designs championed by smaller companies struggled to compete. Though General Atomics made a good go of it with their high-temperature gas-cooled reactor design, their effort birthed the Fort St. Vrain reactor, the first such commercial installation in the U.S. The turnkey era, by all practical measures, ended in 1966, once the industry felt that they had proven nuclear's viability. They returned to building and delivering reactors on the traditional cost-plus contract basis. The projects initiated during that era were also profoundly uneconomical. Years later, vendors found that actual construction costs were about 2 to 3 times higher than the turnkey contract prices, inflicting an estimated $1 billion-plus dollars of financial losses on both vendors. As I mentioned, the PWR and BWR both emerged into the market at around the same time. Westinghouse, Babcock, and Wilcox, and Combustion Engineering championed the PWR. The BWR was backed by General Electric and the American industrial company Alice Chalmers, not to mention their foreign license partners abroad, too. Throughout the 1950s and the first half of the 1960s, they evenly shared the market. But starting in 1970, the PWR pulled ahead of the BWR in terms of world market share. This is in part due to a scalable, more compact design that allowed designers to produce larger reactors that output more power at cheaper cost. A critical development was the wider commercial availability of enriched uranium. In 1970, West Germany, Netherlands, and the UK signed the Treaty of Almelo. The treaty distributed gas centrifuge technology that cut uranium enrichment costs and made light water reactors like the PWR and BWR more economical. Soon after that, the French decided to abandon the British-backed gas-cooled graphite nuclear reactor design and adopt a PWR design licensed by Westinghouse. In 1970, the French embarked on a major PWR construction program. And then came the oil crises of the 1970s, which crimped oil imports and supercharged nuclear power orders. By 1973, U.S. utilities had ordered 41 new units. Between 1962 and 1976, installed capacity doubled every 2 years. However, this surge in new reactor orders unexpectedly ended in the mid-1970s. This can be tied to two major administrative changes, the first of which was Calvert Cliffs. In 1966, the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company applied for and began work on a nuclear power plant license. Several Johns Hopkins scientists in the era grew concerned about the plant ejecting heated cooling water from its secondary cooling loop into the bay. They argued this would harm the area's native blue crab population, the harvest of which is today worth about $20 to $40 million each year. They founded the Calvert Cliffs Commission, which took the Atomic Energy Commission to court for insufficient environmental considerations. In 1971, the D.C. court determined that the AEC was not immune from the environmental reporting requirements of the National Environmental Protection Act, or NEPA. AEC halted its work for 18 months to adjust its regulations. 3 years later, criticism of the AEC's dual role as both regulator and promoter of nuclear matters got to such a point that Congress broke it up, reassigning some of its duties to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. These together ended the American nuclear energy boom. Construction starts petered off after 1974. New reactors were still being completed and started up due to installations being ordered prior to 1974, but new orders basically ended. In 1974, there were 197 reactors on order, but as the build times went on and on, utilities could not handle the spiraling costs plus the uncertainty of whether the plant might ever be completed. In the end, over half of that 197 were eventually canceled. And then came the Three Mile Island incident in 1979. The widely publicized incident put the industry, then already in decline, into a deep freeze that lasted for some 3 decades. The American freeze on new nuclear power plants was damaging for Westinghouse. However, the company found work in foreign markets like France, Japan, and West Germany. Notably in France, by 1975, Westinghouse's PWR designs had defeated GE's BWRs. By 2000, the French completed 58 PWRs. Their nuclear scale-up is one of history's great capital-intensive industrial achievements. Then in the 1990s, Westinghouse was struck by financial scandal, centered on its credit subsidiary, Westinghouse Credit. This subsidiary was formed in the 1950s to help people finance fridges and stoves. Then, in 1986, that very boring Westinghouse Credit subsidiary started issuing aggressive, irresponsible loans for overvalued real estate ventures like hotels. This credit business lifted the company's fortunes during the good times, growing at 18 to 20% each year. Cheap and easy growth. But then in 1990, the pigeons came home to roost, and they brought a lot of poop with them. In the late 1980s, real estate values declined. And so, Westinghouse found itself stuck with over $1 billion of underperforming, often unsecured loans, plus another $1.7 billion of those always terrifying off-balance sheet commitments. To save the company, in 1993, Westinghouse brought in Michael Jordan as their new CEO. Jordan was a longtime turnaround specialist who recently led the Chicago Bulls to the NBA championship. Just kidding. Michael H. Jordan, born in 1936, had served in the Navy before becoming a consultant. Then he spent a long career at Pepsi's International Division before joining Westinghouse as their first outside CEO. Jordan then initiated one of the greatest overhauls in American corporate history. Westinghouse sold off their power generation and industrial businesses to other companies like Siemens and transitioned to being a media company. A series of broadcasting acquisitions followed, topped off by a ballsy $5 billion acquisition of the storied American TV broadcaster CBS in 1995. They even took the CBS name in the process. As part of this remarkable transformation, in 1998, the Westinghouse Company sold its nuclear energy division to the state-owned company British Nuclear Fuels, or BNFL. The transaction was valued at about $1.2 billion. However, BNFL paid less than $100 million in cash. The majority of the value was the assumptions of liabilities. As part of the sale, the Westinghouse Nuclear Division was even allowed to keep the name. After all, CBS did not need it anymore. Since its founding in the 1970s, BNFL was a government-owned but independently financed company that made nuclear fuel and reprocessed spent fuel. When you reprocess spent fuel, you recover uranium from it so that you can make more fuel. In time, BNFL branched off into nuclear cleanup and plant decommissioning services. In the late 1990s, the company seemed on the verge of a partial privatization. The government was going to sell some BNFL shares to the market. So the thinking behind buying Westinghouse, whose designs powered some 70% of the world's nuclear energy plants then, was to let BNFL offer their customers a complete nuclear energy service from cradle to grave, as in from reactor design, to fuel, to servicing, to recycling, and finally, decommissioning. So a year after they acquired Westinghouse Energy, they purchased Combustion Engineering and ABB's commercial nuclear energy businesses. BNFL also saw the Westinghouse deal as not only expanding their range of services, but also facilitating their ability to do more business abroad, like in the United States, Japan, and the emerging market of mainland China. However, financial and operational difficulties darkened the company's prospects. BNFL reported 2002 losses of over £1 billion due to rising labor costs, spiraling liabilities of decommissioning the company's aging Magnox gas-cooled reactors, and lower electricity prices. In response, the UK government canceled plans to IPO BNFL's stock, brought in a new CEO, Mark Parker, and in 2003 announced a major strategy review. That review determined that BNFL should not try to design, own, and operate nuclear sites and just stick to servicing them. So then, on July 2005, the Westinghouse division, which was then profitable, was put up for sale. Many in the media argue the strategic and economic value of keeping the subsidiary, but the sale nevertheless moved forward. When BNFL bought Westinghouse in 1998, the mood around nuclear was at its nadir, still suffering the fallout from the Chernobyl disaster. But just a few years later, things had changed. The BNFL offering attracted inquiries from 15 viable suitors like General Electric, Shaw Group, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, and Toshiba. There was so much interest that BNFL's law firm conducted a second round of bidding to whittle it down. At one time, over 300 people around the world were logged into the virtual data room, accessing and doing diligence on as many as 5,500 documents. Toshiba and Shaw Group ended up winning the bid, paying $5.4 billion in total for Westinghouse. Considering that BNFL paid only about $1 billion a few years earlier, it was a fantastic exit. Their transaction closed in October 2006. So what was Toshiba's play? Basically, the nuclear market seemed ready for an explosive revival, and Nishida wanted to be at the forefront of the good times to come. Nuclear seemed on the cusp of another early 1970s-type breakout. Oil prices in the early 2000s were again on the rise due to various geopolitical crises in the Middle East, plus growing demand in emerging economies like India and the People's Republic of China. In a 2005 report, the IAEA projected $200 billion of nuclear investment over the next 25 years, correlating to a 34-80% increase in nuclear power generation. The political winds had changed too. In June 2005, U.S. President George W. Bush visited the aforementioned Calvert Cliffs nuclear plant. He was the first sitting U.S. president to visit a nuclear plant since Jimmy Carter visited Three Mile Island in 1979. During his visit, he praised nuclear safety and advocated for more plants. That same year, U.S. Congress passed the Energy Policy Act of 2005. This sprawling piece of legislation had several nuclear-oriented incentives, like tax credits, blunted liability claims for potential incidents, and government help for potential cost overruns. Later the following year, Al Gore released the documentary An Inconvenient Truth, which widely publicized the issue of global climate change due to fossil fuel carbons. Broad public support developed for so-called green non-carbon energy sources, and nuclear seemed to catch some of that. Now, Toshiba had already been in the nuclear energy industry for a while. When Japan first adopted nuclear energy in the 1960s, Toshiba and its rival Hitachi were major, almost complementary players in that market. One would provide the nuclear steam supply system and the other the turbine. But almost all the nuclear steam supply systems were boiling water reactor designs originated by General Electric. If you recall, the BWR is the second most popular design in the world, its biggest difference being that it has one water loop rather than the PWR's two. Toshiba, Hitachi, and General Electric even collaborated to create the Advanced Boiling Water Reactor design, one of the first Generation 3 types. There are two ABWRs in Taiwan, the Longmen Nuclear Power Plant in the north. First begun in 1997, the plant was never finished and remains profoundly unpopular here in Taiwan. For that reason, it is unlikely to ever be completed. Anyway, in these cases, Toshiba was the secondary partner behind General Electric. So, in acquiring Westinghouse, the leading designer of the dominant PWR nuclear design, Nishida felt that Toshiba can step forward as the world's leading nuclear power company and grab a larger slice of a growing pie. There was also a substantial China growth angle. At the time, the mainland Chinese only had two operating nuclear plants, but were proposing to build a dozen more new nuclear plants by 2020 at the potential cost of $50 billion. Here, I would like to note that as of February 2023, mainland China has 55 nuclear power plants in operation, producing 57 gigawatts of power, a remarkable achievement. The Chinese government decided to adopt the PWR design. Presumably, Toshiba felt it can benefit from this by acquiring Westinghouse, the leading PWR designer. Toshiba announced ambitious goals in the coming years. In 2005, Westinghouse had $1.8 billion in revenue. They wanted to triple that over the next 10 years, winning 33 reactor orders by 2015. The upside was great, but so was the downside. Nishida was shelling out a lot of money here. Mitsubishi was one of the final bidders, and they murmured in a later interview that Toshiba was overpaying. Ominously, Toshiba's intended financial partner, the trading company Marubeni, pulled out, and it forced Toshiba to bring in the American company Shaw Group for 20%. But in a sign of the leverage they had, Shaw got a put option to force a sale of that 20% share at any time. Even some of Toshiba's directors voiced some concerns. Their senior executive vice president of nuclear power plants said that it would be hard to make back the investment if Toshiba paid anything more than $2.4 billion. They ended up paying more than double that. Regardless, Nishida brushed those concerns aside, saying, "Unless we take a risk, we have no future." The staggering $5 billion price seems especially difficult to swallow considering that Toshiba only made $172 million in profit in the previous year, 2005. The company was not what it had used to be. In 1997, you might have called Toshiba a diversified tech company. Half of their revenue came from producing high-margin products like flash memory, laptop computers, and medical equipment. Moreover, they also made and sold consumer electronics. But in the years since, Toshiba's computers and TV products became uncompetitive. Notably in 2008, Toshiba withdrew from the consumer movie disc player market after the Warner Brothers movie studio dropped their HD DVD standard. By the end of the 2000s, half of Toshiba's revenues came from nuclear power and semiconductors. And it was the ambitious overexpansion in the latter, building two new memory fabs and in 2007 buying the Sony fab, making PS3 cell processors, that sunk Nishida's tenure as CEO. In April 2009, the company unveiled a massive $3.5 billion financial loss after the global financial crisis caused world demand for chips to plunge. The company was forced to cut nearly 4,000 jobs. Nishida stepped down as chief executive and president. However, he remained chairman and used his position to continue watching over his successor, Norio Sasaki. Critical to Toshiba's success was Westinghouse's next-generation nuclear PWR design, the AP1000. The AP1000 descends from the AP600, created in the 1980s. It was originally designed for 600 megawatts electrical capacity, a number then suggested by the utility so that it would be easier for them to add load. The lessons of the Chernobyl disaster showed the need for new safety systems, so the AP stands for Advanced Passive. Passive meaning that if something happens, then the reactor safely shuts itself down using natural forces like gravity, compressed gases, and circulation. Human operator intervention is unnecessary for at least 3 days after the event. In doing this, Westinghouse also removed a substantial number of actively powered safety systems, claiming a third fewer pumps and a fifth as many safety piping as with prior designs. In theory, this not only made the design safer, but also easier to build, maintain, and operate. In December 1999, the NRC certified the AP600 design. However, in the 10-plus years since Westinghouse first began work on that design, some major economic changes. Most importantly, the utilities were deregulated. With this, the AP600's 4.1 to 4.6 cents per kilowatt hour cost was no longer economically competitive against fossil fuels. So, to achieve better economics, Westinghouse scaled up the AP600's size and thus power capacity to 1,000 megawatt electrical, ergo, the AP1000. Much of the AP1000 design was carried over from the AP600, so it only took about 4 years for the NRC to certify the design, though Westinghouse later had to submit new design elements that delayed a final approval into 2011. More on that later. Westinghouse and Toshiba were putting a lot of eggs into the AP1000 basket. 175 out of the prior 180 nuclear reactor projects have gone over budget, by about an average of 117%. 64% have seen extensive delays. The two companies were betting that the AP1000's simpler design would make it easier to build. Moreover, the design was made to be modular, meaning that they build the reactor first as separate modules in the factory, then ship them over to location where they can assemble them with ease. If nuclear was to ever be economically competitive with things like natural gas, then the AP1000's simpler and modular design had to make nuclear truly simpler and cheaper to build than ever before. After the 2005 Energy Act passed, the NRC received 15 to 26 applications from 9 utilities for new nuclear power plants in the United States. And over the next few years, 4 AP1000 reactors were ordered. 2 reactor orders were for the Vogtle Electric Generating Plant in the American state of Georgia. They wanted to add another 2 units to the 2 PWR units they already had, which went live in 1987 and 1989. Back in 1971, those first 2 reactors were estimated to cost just $660 million. The cost inflations and overruns continually inflated estimates to $2.7 billion, and then $5.5 billion, and then $7.2 billion, and finally to $8.9 billion. In 2008, the utility Georgia Power agreed to buy 2 more AP1000 reactors for Vogtle at an initial cost of $14 billion. These were helped by about $8.3 billion in loan guarantees provided by the Obama administration. The other 2 AP1000 reactors were ordered by the Virgil Summer Station in South Carolina. Summer Station had 1 PWR Westinghouse unit that first went live in 1984 and was constructed at a cost of about $4 billion today. For a while, it seemed like nuclear energy really was making a comeback. Then 3 developments and events chilled that momentum. The first was the American shale oil boom of the mid-2000s. The emergence of fracking and horizontal drilling techniques turned fossil fuels, and particularly natural gas, into a juggernaut. This made it even harder for nuclear to compete. Then, after President Obama took office, he promoted and pumped billions of dollars of investment into renewable sources with a particular focus on wind and solar. Backed by the full might of the Chinese solar and wind manufacturing juggernaut, wind power costs fell by 40% and solar power 50% in the 7 years after 2008. Naturally, utilities chose to install more wind and solar power. During Obama's 2 terms in office, wind power capacity tripled and solar power grew 25 times over. Nuclear power was left behind. And finally, the third and most impactful event was, of course, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011. Those reactors were BWRs designed by General Electric and supplied by both Toshiba and Hitachi. One can argue that the AP1000's passive safety systems addressed the risks of another Fukushima, which fundamentally concerned an extended loss of power. For example, the inclusion of a large water tank on top of the containment building that would passively dump down into the reactor core, cooling it. Nevertheless, the Fukushima incident spurred a massive new upswell of protest from environmental groups who argued that the AP1000 design lacked proper containment, that 1 in a million events are more common than previously thought, and that it was too soon after the disaster to approve new plants. After making the mistake of going too hard into semiconductors, Toshiba's new chief executive Sasaki cut investment into new memory fabs and led the company back into the industrial sector. But Fukushima damaged Toshiba's prospects in that business. Countries like Germany and Switzerland canceled their projects, hurting the order book. That, combined with the growing tensions between Sasaki and Nishida, spurred another leadership change. In February 2013, Sasaki stepped down as CEO and president for Hisao Tanaka. Nishida remained chairman of the board. In March 2013, construction crews broke ground on both the Vogtle and Summer projects. It marked the first American attempt at building a new nuclear power plant in 30 years. If it went well, the number of other nuclear power plants in Florida, South Carolina, and North Carolina might follow on. Unfortunately, it did not go well. One of the keys to the AP1000 thesis was that its relative simplicity and modularity made it easier to build at the location. However, this only pushed the complexity from the job site into the supply chain, kind of like with the Boeing 787. America hadn't built a new nuclear plant in 30 years. It's no surprise that the suppliers struggled. Surfacing problems, Toshiba and Westinghouse did not foresee with their design. For example, the U.S. manufacturer Curtiss-Wright Corporation struggled to produce the plant's reactor coolant pumps. It one time discovered that a blade inside the pumps had broken off, forcing 2 years of design fixes. The project hit setbacks from the very beginning. Reuters reported how when Toshiba and its construction partners began preparing the plant's foundation in 2009, they discovered that the material used did not meet code, delaying the build by 6 months. Moreover, the NRC closely monitored the builds, demanding changes to the design, then already approved, to handle new situations. For example, a new standard for the concrete shield to withstand a crash by a commercial jet. This was what delayed the final approval into 2011. Internally, relations between the managers within Toshiba and Westinghouse soured. Toshiba management lacked insight into what was going on inside its own division, and the Westinghouse guys perhaps a bit too proud of themselves over in the United States. It was so bad that when Toshiba's newest chief executive, Hisao Tanaka, took office in 2013, he was shocked to find that these new design changes would cost Westinghouse, and thus Toshiba, another $1 to $2 billion. Here begins the cost overruns. The hard but right thing to do would be to announce these losses. That was what the accountants and Toshiba's various audit committees argued for. But Hisao Tanaka knew that doing this would call into question Westinghouse's entire value as an asset, and thus lead to an impairment of Westinghouse's goodwill. If you recall from your accounting courses in college, goodwill refers to the intangible asset on a company's books after making an acquisition. You buy a company for $6, but their assets are worth $3. The rest is booked as goodwill. If you realize the company you bought is worth less than that $6, you got to write it down. A goodwill impairment like that would blow a hole into Toshiba's books and call the company's entire financial position into question. Then came yet another financial blow. If you recall, Shaw Group was Toshiba's partner in the Westinghouse deal, but only on the condition of receiving a put option, or in other words, the option to force a sale of their 20% share at any time. In 2012, Shaw Group exercised that option. That year, Shaw Group was acquired by the engineering company Chicago Bridge and Iron. Their nuclear power engineering and construction subsidiary was reorganized as CB&I Stone Webster. As troubles intensified as the Vogtle and Summer nuclear projects, Toshiba decided to purchase this Stone Webster division in October 2015 from Chicago Bridge and Iron for about $229 million. In other words, they were getting directly involved into the Vogtle and Summer plant builds. Toshiba believed that taking direct control of the construction would improve the module building work down in Louisiana, accelerate construction, and settle ongoing lawsuits with the utilities over who should shoulder the additional cost. They did no diligence on Stone Webster before buying it. Toshiba's managers were hiding a few other problems too. If you remember from much earlier in this video, Nishida rose up through Toshiba's personal computer division. And so the story goes, he got the top job because he managed to save the laptop business from financial ruin, twice. The story adds that Nishida achieved the latter turnaround by investing heavily into contract manufacturers. This is true. However, he also greatly inflated the division's profitability using certain buy-sell transactions. In a buy-sell transaction, Toshiba first buys the components for a laptop, like the LCD panels or semiconductors, from the supply chain. They then sell those parts to a contract manufacturer at a premium price, booking a profit from the transaction. The issue is that Toshiba eventually rebuys the completed laptop from the contract manufacturer. Buy-sell transactions are not illegal per Japanese accounting standards. They can even be quite common. The issue is when you manipulate the size of the premium to artificially inflate profits. It's likely that Nishida started, or at least pushed, the practice of inflating buy-sell transactions to turn around the laptop PC division in 2004 and win the CEO spot. The PC division accounted for a third of the estimated $1 plus billion in inflated profits from 2006 to 2013. But the practice spread throughout the entire business, including infrastructure, TV, and semiconductors. One 2011 smart metering project done for the utility TEPCO booked some $200 million in overstated profit alone. When the scandal came out in 2015, it forced out much of the senior management circle, including then-CEO Hisao Tanaka, Vice Chairman Sasaki, and advisor Nishida. Afterwards, Toshiba started selling off their various businesses to raise money. In December, they sold their consumer electronics division to the Chinese appliance maker Midea for about $500 million. Midea basically just bought the brand so that they can wear it like some animal skin. Toshiba's once respected line of notebook PCs no longer made money and was later shut down entirely. Toshiba also sold their MRI, X-ray, and ultrasound medical diagnostics division, Toshiba Medical Systems Corporation, or TMSC, to Canon for about $5.9 billion. TMSC had been a major, steadily profitable business. The sale proceeds, though, were almost immediately wiped out by the nuclear losses to come. The nuclear debacle just kept getting worse. Looking back at it, the December 2015 acquisition of the CBNI nuclear division was the straw that broke the camel's back. After taking direct control of the build, Toshiba struggled to find the right construction workers, maintain quality, and build up a global supply chain after 30 years of cruft. Worst of all, it pinned Toshiba, then already reeling from the accounting scandal and falling flash memory prices with billions in liabilities, as the delays and costs of the two nuclear sites accumulated. CBNI could have helped pay for some of that, but instead, they got to wipe their hands clean and walk away scot-free. Toshiba had to write down the value of the CBNI Stone & Webster acquisition. Then, they accused CBNI of artificially inflating the value of the subsidiary by billions to get a better sale price, and the whole thing went to court. Behind the scenes, Toshiba's audit committee kept urging the company to announce the massive losses growing inside Westinghouse. The longer things delayed, the more they owed. And it finally came out in 2016. In April 2016, Toshiba wrote down the Westinghouse nuclear division by $2.3 billion, though at the time, they still insisted that entities in China and India would be buying AP1000 reactors for years to come. Then-CEO Masashi Muromachi said at the time of the announcement, "Regardless of the write-down, the nuclear business is progressing as planned." Sadly, it was not. In December 2016, they announced a future second write-off of unknown quantity. The size of that loss would not be known until February 2017, a staggering $6.3 billion. The shares, already down over 25% from late 2016, dumped further. In February 2017, Westinghouse filed for bankruptcy, a sad end for a legendary American company and 50-plus years of history in the nuclear industry. A year later, in 2018, Toshiba sold their crown jewel flash memory semiconductor business, a division that once struck fear in the hearts of the American semiconductor makers, to a consortium led by Bain Capital for $18 billion. In South Carolina, the two utilities backing the summer power plant project had invested $9 billion into the venture, but the cost of finishing the project had ballooned to $25 billion. A few months after the Westinghouse bankruptcy, the whole summer project was canceled in July 2017, a stunning conclusion. Billions spent for a plant that won't generate any electricity. The debacle was dubbed Nukegate. The utilities and others involved were immediately smacked with lawsuits from all affected parties, and it took $1 billion to settle them. The various government authorities initiated civil and criminal investigations. One of the utilities, Scana, saw two of its executives, including its CEO, convicted for defrauding ratepayers about the status of the project. Their stock also crashed, forcing the parent company to sell itself to Dominion Energy in January 2019. That acquisition was also criticized. Good times all around. The other utility stayed independent, but both utilities, and thus their ratepayers, will be paying off billions of debt over the next 12 to 20 years. And again, for something that never delivered power. As for Georgia, Toshiba and Westinghouse focused their resources on completing Vogtle Units 3 and 4, aided with a $3.7 billion payment from Toshiba, and I give them full credit for their dogged determination to finish the job. And they finished it. Unit 3 began operations in July 2023, Unit 4, April 2024. Together, they cost about $35 billion to build, some $21 billion over budget, and 6 to 7 years late. But Vogtle is now America's largest nuclear power plant. Right now, as of this writing, there are no nuclear reactors currently under construction in the United States. Westinghouse's equity is now held by the Canadian investment company Brookfield Business Partners. Toshiba is a shell of itself. In 2023, they got bought out by private equity for about $15 billion. Their remaining businesses are energy, hard disk drives, power semiconductors, and IT. They recently moved to cut 5,000 jobs, and they currently still employ around 67,000 people. Nowadays, nuclear is having a bit of a moment again, thanks to AI. But the same economic challenges of the past 40 years remain. The builds take too long and cost too much. Toshiba and Westinghouse stand as a monument to what can happen if things go wrong, as they so easily seem to do. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.